Socrates, Part 2, the seventh talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 14, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 3 in this series.
To begin with, just an announcement. This was publicized this way early on, but just so you all know, we only have 1 week left after this, and it's not next week. Next week is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and so we're not going to meet that week. We will meet the following week, and that'll actually be the end until we come back from holiday break. No, don't show up next week.
Jack, will the class continue?
It will, starting in January. Yeah, the first one, the first John, will be done. But
the next session, he'll do First John tonight, skip next week, and do First John again, and then First John's done. So we have two more today and the next time.
Then after that?
After that, we just keep doing this class.
Okay.
Starting in January, I think it's the second week of January. And yeah, and in place of the first John, the last I heard, it won't start right away, but starting sometime mid-February, Tim McIntosh is going to do a class on American church history. Okay, so we're talking about Socrates. I presume we will finish tonight on Socrates, but we'll just see how it goes. So I gave you a handout last week. It should still be online for those of you online, called in the section we're going to look at is Socrates' project. I think we already talked, did we not? I believe we last week talked about the Socratic method and dialectic. Oh, we didn't talk about that? Okay, well then we'll talk about that after we talk about his project. So what is Socrates' project? These are just seven things that kind of came to mind as I just sat back and thought about what do you find in his dialogues and what are the themes and what are the emphases. So I don't promise that this is exhaustive. This just happens to be what came to mind for me. So there may be some glaring omission that I just haven't noticed. But this captures many of the themes that you would find reading through his dialogues. The first one is that his project, and that by that I mean by project, that's a philosopher's way of describing what he was up to in his teaching and his thinking. You know, what was his purpose? What was his goal? What was he trying to get accomplished? He sought to call people to that which is substantial and eternal and away from that which is superficial and temporal. So a very important theme, and it's especially juxtaposed against the agenda and the project, if you will, of the sophist. Because as you remember from last week, what the project of the sophist was to equip you to be successful in the polis, the city-state in ancient Greece. They wanted to teach you to talk real good so that you could use your good talking to get your way, basically, to persuade people to give you what you wanted. Talk was power in that culture, so they were going to teach you how to talk persuasively, be able, and dare I say, manipulatively. So they wanted to teach you how to manipulate people in order to get those people to get you what you want. We have always had sophists with us. We always will have sophists with us. I could name some by name, but I won't. Sophists are the demagogues of any democracy. Well, the problem, as Socrates saw it with the sophist, is, I mean, let alone from the evil and the immorality of being manipulative. I mean, that would be part of his critique as well. But setting that aside, what is it that they're giving people? Something that is only for this world, is not going to last, and is not substantial. I mean, so what if you have if you've made a name for yourself and you have power and glory within the state? So what? You are losing your soul. You have no substance to your being. So you have no substance to your being now, and you're not going to get a particularly good outcome in the end after you die. So Socrates is keenly aware that you are living now to prepare yourself for a beneficial, rewarded existence in the afterlife. Now, Socrates is presented by Plato as believing in reincarnation. My sense of that is that if you were to actually ask Socrates himself, he'd say, I don't know what happens. I really don't know. So Plato is putting what I think is Plato's doctrine into Socrates' mouth when he has Socrates talk about reincarnation. But at the same time that he puts it in his mouth, what's very interesting and what makes me think that Socrates did not actually believe in reincarnation is that every time Socrates tells a myth about how evil people go into Hades, go to Hades, and this happens and that happens, and then they come back, their soul comes back as a donkey or as a some kind of animal or something. And the only one who gets set free is the philosopher. The philosopher's soul gets set free from body altogether and goes back to live among the forms in the heavens and has an eternally blessed existence. So that's the philosopher. So see ya. But all of that, I think, is just a Platonic doctrine, and how seriously Plato took it, it's difficult to say. But what I was going to say is, every time Socrates is presented as giving a myth or an account, it's never the same account. They're always different accounts. And he always says, well, I heard a priestess tell the story that, or I heard a philosopher teach that. So he's making it secondhand. And he'll typically end it with, now whether that's true or not, I can't say, but if something like that is true, then shouldn't we live like this? And that's always the point that Socrates draws out of it. So that's why I think that Socrates himself was primarily a moral philosopher, or wanting to teach us how to live our lives right now, didn't pretend to know what the big picture was and the mysteries of metaphysics, what they were, or even the mysteries of life after death. He didn't really pretend to know that. But what he did know is it's going to go well for you after death if you live right now, and it will not go well for you after death if you don't live right now. That's pretty clear that he believed that, I think. So that becomes a prominent theme in his teaching is, shouldn't we live in such a way that we take care of our soul? Shouldn't we live in such a way that it will go well for us after we die rather than not? And then right alongside of that is this kind of emphasis about what makes a good person good anyway? What gives substance to your being? What makes you good? What makes you, and the word that usually gets used in the Platonic dialogues is virtue. So let me go to the second point. Part of his project is to define virtue, and I translate it human excellence, to define it as the love of and pursuit of the good. And by that, he means roughly moral goodness, what I would call moral goodness. And that's true rather than social political success. So one and two go hand in hand, because social political success is shallow, superficial, and temporary. That which counts, that is substantive and eternal, is true human virtue, true human excellence, which is the pursuit of that which is good and true. OK, Okay, I want to come back to one in a second, but let me finish talking about two for a second. Virtue is a term that if you do ever bother to read any Plato in English, they're typically going to translate, there's a word they're going to translate virtue. And what they mean an excellence, human excellence. It's much like wisdom in the Old Testament. Remember when Moses is building the temple, God instructs them to find someone who has the wisdom to work in copper or the wisdom to work in bronze or whatever. That wisdom is really basically any understanding of anything that allows you to perform. The understanding that brings skill, that allows you to engage in something skillfully and artfully. That's a virtue. That's what the word wisdom means in Hebrew. The Greek word arete is used in the same way. So if any of you have read Meno, the dialogue Meno, he asks the question, what is virtue? And several of the initial answers are, well, it's different for different people. The slave has a virtue of being a slave, and the musician, the lute player, has a virtue of being a lute player, and so on. That is, they are skilled at what it is they are skilled at. That's their virtue. And what he means by that is, if you're excellent at something, then that is the virtue that you have with respect to that thing. So don't be confused, because in our, that word has a very, very interesting history throughout the whole history of Western civilization. And at one point, virtue meant simply and exclusively being sexually chaste, yeah. Sexual chastity. Sexual chastity is virtue, plain and simple. And then I think since then, that was in the Victorian era, since then it's expanded a little bit to be strictly to be moral as opposed to immoral. A virtuous person is a moral person. But don't be faked out by that, because virtue doesn't really mean morality. It means excellence. So the question he's asking is, what is virtue? He's asking, what does it mean to be an excellent human being and to have an excellent human existence? Well, is it being powerful? Is it being wealthy? Is it being socially accepted, having glory and honor in the eyes of other people? Is that an excellent existence if you get to the end of that and you have that? And Socrates is quite clear, well, no, not really. What makes an excellent human existence is to be an individual who loves the good such that they pursue the good. That's an excellent human being. So virtue is to live and act well because you love well, basically, because you love that which is good. All right, now let me back up for a second. So here we have Socrates who thinks that what's excellent in humanity and that which is substantial, which happens to also be eternal, is to love the good, or goodness and truth, or really it's a triad for Plato, and I think probably Socrates, goodness, beauty, and truth. He just sort of speaks of them all together, typically. To love beauty and goodness and truth is what it means to be a truly substantial and excellent human being. Well, is that God? Is that the biblical concept of God? Is that the same as loving God? Whether that was true for Socrates or not, it's kind of difficult to say. I think the evidence points in the direction that, because he talks about God on a number of occasions as well. So I think Socrates would combine those. God is the one who is the source of, the origin of goodness and beauty and truth. So to love goodness and beauty of truth is to love God, and vice versa for him. Now, if it's not true, then there's a deficiency, I would think, from a biblical perspective in Socrates' position. Because goodness and beauty and truth are abstractions. And I think of, as a young evangelical growing up in the evangelical church, if you had told me, you know, life is all about loving goodness and truth and beauty, I would have kind of been put off by that. Everybody knows that we need to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what it's all about. Or alternatively, a personal relationship with God. Now, I grew up kind of Baptistic background. And the problem we always had with Catholics is they don't have a personal relationship with God or Jesus Christ. They're just into liturgy and religion and stuff like that. So they do this religion over here, but we Baptists, we have a personal relationship with God. I'm highlighting the emphasis there. It seems to me the biblical truth is between, or is a synthesis of the Christian cultural emphasis, in at least in certain Christian traditions, and Socrates understood as loving abstractions. Neither of those quite capture the biblical picture. The biblical picture is you are loving a person, a real person who really is there. But it's a real person who really is there, who really is the source and origin of all that is good and of all that is true and that all that is beautiful and so on. So to emphasize goodness and beauty and truth is a wonderful corrective to the impoverished notion of loving God as a person without that having any implications for loving goodness and beauty and truth, if you see what I'm saying. Because for me, the emphasis was so much on having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ that, you know, Jesus Christ could have been a monster and that would have been okay as long as you were loving him and having a personal relationship with him. I mean, I never would have said that. But you understand, if you strip, if you so emphasize the personal relationship that you strip away from it who that person is, what he values, what he represents, such that you include in a love for that person that which he is the origin of and that which he embraces, then you're not really loving that person. So Socrates is capturing one side of that. Cultural Christianity, the one that I grew up in, narrowly captures the other side of that. We've got to keep them both together. Because that's the biblical perspective, I think. To love God is to love righteousness. You can't love God without loving righteousness. And if you love righteousness without loving the person who's the source of that, what's that? How do you love an abstraction? What are we even talking about? And clearly there's so much more. I mean, you can go a certain way down that path. Loving righteousness is being committed to pursuing that which is right. Okay, that makes sense. And that's certainly part of loving God. But I guess we haven't said it in this class. We are ultimately all going to be tested in our love for God. And if I simply decided I want to live my life in pursuit of righteousness and forget all this God as a person stuff, I'm just doing the right thing by committing my life to pursuing righteousness. The problem is, what happens when some circumstances come along in my life and I am dealt with unjustly? Some evil person harms me. What do I do with that if my only love is for righteousness? Well, I probably want to kill them, you know, because what they did is unjust. They violated righteousness. I'm going to uphold righteousness. I think I need to kill the dude. I mean, that would probably be the right thing to do. But that's not the biblical thing to do, because we have to come to terms with mercy and forgiveness, for example. So how do I have to deal with my life circumstances? Does God have the right to do that to me? Does God have the right to allow that in my life? Can I allow God to wound me, to harm me? And true wisdom and true maturity works through that and says, though he slay me, yet I will worship him. You know, okay, he's God. He's the one in control. He's the author of all reality. God has ordained that I get hurt here. Yet I love him anyway. I can still pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Yes, I want your will to be done, even if it costs me my life. or even if it costs me my reputation, or even if it costs me everything I own, I want your will to be done, because you're the author. You're the one who knows what he's doing, and I have come to know you, and in knowing you, I have come to like who you are and how you run your universe. I don't always understand it, and sometimes it hurts like hell, God, but I've come to know who you are and trust you. I want your way to be done. I don't think Socrates is going to go there. Because he's not dealing with God at exactly that level. And so in that regard, I think there's really a sort of a deficiency in Socrates' perspective. Or anybody who tries to just abstract from God goodness and beauty and truth and kind of leave God out of it. But never mind the person running reality part of it. I don't want to believe in that. I mean, that's fiction, that's fairy tale, I'm a respectable, intelligent human being, and all I believe in is goodness and righteousness. Well, that's not ultimately going to work very well in real life, because in real life you have to deal with the ups and downs of your actual existence. Is that clear enough?
How did Socrates define goodness? I mean, he's living in a world where all of a sudden he starts saying you have to be a good person. Well, how did the people around him, I mean, did he try to define it? Did he?
Well, to some extent he does. I don't recall him ever actually addressing that question in that way directly. I think we could look at several of the dialogues and several of the conversations in the dialogues where, in effect, he's partially answering that question by, like, for example, there's one dialogue that's really funny. It's the question is, what is piety? That is, what is reverence for the gods? And the guy's on his, the guy that he's talking to is on his way to the law court to sue his father, and take him for all he's worth. And Socrates gets in what is kind of a comical conversation about, well, okay, you're going to sue your father, but it's important that we show reverence to the gods. How do you put those two things together? So there are ways he highlights and underlines and dramatizes the moral failings of various people, sometimes comically, sometimes not so comically. But I don't think he ever tries to define it per se, just not to my knowledge.
Do we have a sense of what goodness is without really having a definition for it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I remember early in my Christian life, receiving the teaching that, you know, in the Ten Commandments or in the Bible generally, that's what defines what the difference between right and wrong or good and evil, and that's our definition of that. And that proves to be very misleading and very confusing, actually, because the Bible never does define what right and wrong is. It doesn't think it needs to. Our problem as human beings is not our lack of knowledge of what's good and what's evil. It's our inability to do what's good rather than what's evil. We know what good is. We just don't do it. Any pagan can know what good is. Now, granted, you always have borderline cases where it gets confusing. What should I do in this situation? And you have all these complicated scenarios that make it a very difficult conundrum that we have to. Yeah, there are times and places where it may get difficult to know what the good thing to do is. But those are relatively few and far between. And in any case, that's not our problem. When it gets to the judgment seat, I'm not going to be held accountable for the moral conundrums that I got the wrong answer to. I'm going to be held accountable for all those times when I knew good and well what I was supposed to do and I didn't do it. That's what damns me. Is there a question? Yeah.
Bill's wondering if you could give a reference for the yet he slay me, still I will worship him.
You mean like Numbers? Like chapter and verse?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, no, I can't. It's in Job. I have no idea where, but early in Job, relatively early in Job. Okay, anything else on the first two? Okay, number three part of his project was to expose the so-called wisdom of mankind generally as ignorance and confusion. That whole emphasis on, well, I guess we don't really know, do we? I don't think that's an accident that so many of his dialogues, you know, the dialogue starts with, well, what is X? And they go through this long discussion and dialogue back and forth. There are a couple of dialogues where they'll get to a point where Socrates will talk them out of their concept and he will supply another one. And then he gets all their agreement and he says, oh, wait, no, we got that wrong. Here's why we got that wrong. And he comes and he argues for exactly the opposite perspective by the end. And then he says, well, I guess we don't know what X is, do we? So I don't think it's an accident that you're always ending there, because part of what he's doing is to simply instill, his project is to instill in us the appropriate kind of humility. We're not nearly as smart as we think we are. We're not nearly as wise as we think we are. We're not nearly as knowledgeable as we think we are. We're really puffed up little twerps, basically, is what we are. And we take ourselves way too seriously. And Socrates wants to bring us back down to earth and get some perspective on ourselves. And I think I already talked about his own biography, that a friend went to the oracle at Delphi, who's the wisest person in Athens. The answer came back, Socrates, and Socrates went, what? And finally he figured out that he was the wisest person in Athens because he knew he wasn't wise, whereas everyone else is all pretense, pretending to be wise when they are not. And related to that then, to expose the pride and the hubris of the typical man, he is not good and he is not as successful as he thinks he is. He is bad and he is unsuccessful. Now, in what way is he unsuccessful? That goes back to the first two points, because his success is so shallow. It's not real success. It's not substantial. It's not the thing that really makes a human being a significant human being. Now, having said that, yet Socrates does seem to have an inadequate view of sin. It's hard to tell. Because, I mean, as anything is hard to tell with Socrates, because all we have are the dialogues. We don't have a systematic presentation of his views, so we just have to glean what we can from the dialogues. But you don't have anything in the dialogues where Socrates is exploring in depth moral depravity the way Paul explores it in the book of Romans, for example, or the way Jesus explores it with in his dialogues with the Pharisees, for example. The depth that they go to seeing how fundamentally depraved we are, there's nothing comparable to that in Socrates. So you have to wonder, did he have really maybe a deficient understanding of human depravity? One of the things that might suggest so is on two or three occasions, Socrates explores a doctrine that's a famous Socratic doctrine, where he says to know the good is to do the good, that our problem is ignorance. If we just knew what really was ultimately in our best interest, then we would do it. But we don't do it, so what's the problem? We must not really know and must not really understand what is ultimately in our own best interest. Does that prove that Socrates had a deficient view of sin? Not exactly, not really, because you could also hear Paul saying such a thing. It depends on what you mean by know. At what level? Know to what extent? Know in what way? Because I could see Paul arguing that sin, by its very nature, is of such a nature that it makes us dumb. It makes us stupid. We act irrationally. We act self-destructively. And certainly that's true. Sin does make us act self-destructively. So you could almost hear Paul, if you're just analyzing sin at a certain sense, at a certain level, saying that in the way, as sinners, our problem is ignorance. And Paul on a couple of occasions uses the word ignorance. He describes himself at one point, when I was ignorant in my something or other. And he's not using it as exculpatory. He's not saying, don't blame me because I was ignorant. It doesn't excuse him. He's accusing himself of being ignorant and therefore being culpable, being evil. I was foolish. And that foolishness is a deep kind of sinfulness, a deep kind of evil that affects every human being unless they have been enlightened by God. So it's just difficult to know how deep Socrates' concept of sin might have gone. It may have gone as deep or nearly as deep as Paul's, but he certainly is never presented as teaching it with the clarity that Paul does. You don't have anything like the good that I wanted to do, I did not do. The very evil that I did not want to do, that's what I did. I find then the principle that evil is present in me, the one who wishes to do good. You never have that kind of clarity coming out of Socrates. And I think it's a very, it'd be a very interesting question that I'm not sure I know the answer to, but do we ever choose in our rebellion to do something that we fully know in the fullest possible sense of the word understand, that we understand is damning us and is destroying us and is counterproductive to my well-being? I think the answer might be yes to that. And Paul is certainly preparing us to answer that yes. Socrates doesn't say anything to prepare us to answer that yes. Okay, any questions or comments on that?
In the past, you've suggested that Socrates was a prophet. I'm not saying you're contradicting yourself necessarily, but in order for Socrates to have been a prophet, would he have needed to subscribe to the biblical view on sin? I mean, obviously, it's not crystal clear whether he does or not.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. When I call him a prophet, let's put that in quotes. He's a prophet, not a prophet. Because what I mean by that is just that he's playing a role. Someone like George Whitefield arguably was a prophet to America. Billy Graham maybe, in a sense, was a prophet to America, even though he has some lousy theology. But look at how God used him to confront people with the choice that they had to make and the importance of the choice that they had to make. I only mean prophet in the sense that God had put them in a certain place and time in history and given them a role to kind of wake people up and confront them and invite them and call them to take God seriously. So they're not somebody you would look to for the truth. It's not revealed truth that they're giving you, but they're playing a role like a prophet played a role in Israel to kind of call people to repentance. That's what I mean by prophet. But I wouldn't in any way put them in the same category as the Hebrew prophets in the Old Testament who are actually revealing God's word to us, where their message was God's message. I don't mean to suggest that Socrates played that role.
For quite a long time, I thought that when you said prophet, that you meant biblical prophet.
Yeah,
but
no.
Looks like I misunderstood you, Ben.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I probably should have been clearer. Yeah, I don't mean a biblical prophet.
Jack, if I remember correctly, I think both Jesus and Paul would have said that a person who is, and I think I've heard you say, if we are good people, if we pursue good, that doesn't mean that we always are perfect in
mm-hmm.
doing good,
mm-hmm.
which sounds a little different than what Socrates is saying here. Or would he agree with Paul that to know good is to do good, do the good?
So help me, why might he be saying something different than Paul here? What are you thinking here?
Well, if I'm just reading this literally. To know the good is to do the good.
Okay.
But we all know that from a biblical sense, we're basically evil people.
Right.
And even though we may strive to do good, do the good.
Uh-huh.
We don't always do good.
Right, right. So this sounds automatic, that if you know it, you'll do it. And so what's with that, knowing it and not doing it? Yeah, but even in, I think in fairness to Socrates, he would recognize that you could know something superficially and not do it. You could know the good in a superficial sense without doing the good. But I think he's talking about a deeper understanding, a deeper knowledge, to really deeply understand goodness and what it implies and what it entails would necessarily result in your doing it. And that's why I say, once you've qualified it by saying deeply understand it, would Paul then maybe agree with him? Well, maybe. That would be an interesting conversation to hear them have, because I could see that maybe Paul would say, well, if that's what you're talking about, then yeah. But the problem is, we can know the good without deeply knowing the good then, don't we? The good that I superficially know, I do not deeply know. and have that, you know, write that chapter from that perspective. And he might very well do that. Because I think what Paul and Socrates could agree on, I think, is where Socrates is coming from is reason is huge for him. That doing what's good is doing what is rational. I mean, it's just irrational to do evil. So if you really understood how rational it is to do the good, then you would do it. It must be that you don't get it, that you don't understand how rational it is, otherwise, and that's why you don't do it. Well, I think that's true. I think it's fair to say, from a biblical perspective, acting evilly is irrational. Yeah, it is. Now, our biggest problem is not our irrationality. Our biggest problem resides in our passion and in our will, not in our reason. Our reason is affected by our passion and our will. I mean, when I rebel against truth, I become dumb to what's true. I just don't even think straight. So, but even deeper than my bad thinking is my bad loving. I don't love the right things. I don't have a passion for the right things, and I don't will it. I don't choose it. Socrates is not working with those categories, with the distinction between reason and will, reason and he certainly does have the category of love, but he doesn't have the category of will. And I think that's why he approaches it so differently, is that he doesn't place the same emphasis on the choice that we have to make. So it's harder for him to recognize a gap between what we know and what we choose, which is relatively easy for Paul to articulate by comparison.
I had a question about, so you're saying he's a prophet, but how is your view take into account the daimon or whatever? Just wondering if they're wondering if you can go over that again a little bit.
Well, I'm just suspicious that that daimon may very well have been the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who was kind of tangibly and supernaturally guiding him through the role that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had given to him to play in Greek culture in the ancient world. But just because God is supernaturally guiding him doesn't mean that God has supernaturally appointed him to play the same role of speaking for God himself like the Hebrew prophets did. I would never trust Socrates like I would trust Isaiah, if I could understand Isaiah.
And then I just had a personal comment is, since we had been reading Plato for forever, and that it is interesting that he does bring up the will in a couple of the dialogues we did read.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, in the sense that he views the will as almost this thing that's secondary to reason, and like he's like, well, you're only really willing something when you're rational. Right. Every other time, you're just a slave to your passions.
Right.
I thought that's kind of interesting. In some ways, it kind of mirrors some of what I think Paul talks about, but not exactly in the same way. And I think he is thinking about it a little bit.
Yeah,
the language sometimes kind of sounds similar.
Yeah, I think that's a very profound point, is that, yes, the will is there, but it only registers what the passions want or what the reason wants. And I just don't think that's a healthy and or robust enough view of the will. It's not just registering my passions versus my reason. It's actually, it actually creates my being because it creates my choice and therefore defines who I am. Now, true, it's reacting to, it's choosing between what my reason tells me and what my passions tell me, and that picture's helpful at times, but it's not just a weak register of that. It's not a slave of one or the other. It actually is the master that's going to decide who has the say. And so I think it's that stronger, more robust view of will that helps us understand sin better than we can understand it through Socrates' categories.
Over here. So I was looking up online the other day about the whole daimon thing, and I guess etymologically we get a word demon from that, you know that.
Right.
And
right.
So when was the development when it became something wicked or some kind of unclean spirit? Because I was even reading people who argued that linguistic development hadn't showed up even until the Gospels, that maybe the Gospel writers had some concept that these people weren't possessed with some kind of, you know, wicked ghosts, but that they were possessed with a god or something like that. And I thought that was maybe a stretch, but it made me wonder when was there even any change between that word meaning predominantly a god or some kind of, you know, force like that, and then somehow meaning predominantly some unclean spirit or something.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That would be very interesting to trace that and see if we have enough information to tell that story. But I've never done that, and I don't know.
Okay.
Now, in the Gospels, more often than not, they're not called demons, though. They're called unclean spirits. So the uncleanness of them is very explicit.
I guess maybe one of those people would argue that the unclean spirit was like an unclean god or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Maybe they would argue that. Mm. But I know they were just arguing that that shift in language hadn't happened until the Gospels.
That could be.
You think so, really?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'll have to look into it more. So the other thing was, you were talking about the biblical perspective and the universality of the attribution of sin, that we're all sinners, right? And I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but it seems that when you look at the Bible, this universal attribution of everybody inherently being some kind of sinner doesn't seem to show up really until Paul. Elsewhere, I would say in the Old Testament, you have stuff like you have the sinners and you have the wicked people. You have the sinners, the wicked people, and the righteous people. And the righteous people are the ones who are going to be saved, and the wicked people are the ones who are going to perish. That distinction of being some kind of righteous sinner isn't really there in the Old Testament. Have you thought about that at all?
I haven't thought about it enough. I'd be surprising if you couldn't find it at all in the Old Testament. It may be more... I would grant you that I can't think of any place that just sort of explicitly outlines that as a category and a doctrine. At least nothing comes immediately to mind. But I think if you looked at the way sin is dealt with in a number of places, like some of the Psalms, for example, I think you'd find certainly the foundations of Paul's doctrine there. But I would imagine that Paul has that kind of clarity on human sin because he wrestled with the meaning of the cross. And in order to really understand the meaning and significance of Jesus' death on the cross, as Jesus himself defined it, he came to realize that a corollary to the meaning and significance of the cross is the utter depravity of mankind where every last one of us deserve what Jesus got. And short of that, the cross doesn't make any sense. So it wouldn't surprise me if Paul is the first clearest exposition of that, because he's the one who's really kind of putting the final touches on the understanding of the gospel post-Christ, when the Messiah ended up getting himself dead and having to figure that out.
I just had a comment to see the glasses through which perhaps Socrates was looking at life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been looking at kind of right hemisphere, left hemisphere development. And left hemisphere is broadly a more cognitive side of our brain. And he was a very cognitive man, very rational. Yeah. That's really where he lived his life. And so to understand the gospel through that more rational perspective means it just makes a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't preclude that the other would also be true, but he wouldn't have those lenses
okay.
that have been well developed
mm-hmm.
or an integration of those two sides of the brain to help him come to a more broad and full understanding
mm-hmm.
that Paul had.
Yeah, that may very well be exactly right, because it's hard to read his dialogues without realizing how important cognition is to him. So, yeah, maybe that's just his experience, the way he interprets his own experience.
Because that's the only part of him he's right. really developed well. So okay. the real possibility, and it could mean a whole lot more than what it looks like on the surface because
right.
of that.
Right. Good.
Sorry, there was just a quick comment from the online person about your thing, and he's just quoting Isaiah, where Isaiah says something about righteousness being like unclean rags or something like that. That
oh,
kind
okay.
of possibly... It seems like it does deal with it somewhat.
Okay. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. Moving on. Just what follows from the first 4 points is that part of his project was to encourage men to pursue knowledge and understanding on their own rather than put their trust in sophists. They're these pretenders who are presuming to take your money and make you wise, make you virtuous. And Socrates is saying, They don't have that much to offer you. I think if you're intent on learning, you can learn it on your own. I mean, there's all kinds of things that suggest you already have the knowledge in you. You just need to kind of find it and bring it out. He gets pretty fancy doctrines, so-called doctrine of recollection. Now, I think that's a Platonic doctrine rather than a Socratic doctrine. But the doctrine of recollection is that before our souls became embodied in this world, our souls hung out with the forms up in formland. There you go, up in formland, and we were dazzled by the beauty of the forms and so on. But becoming embodied, of course, always wrecks everything. You know, clouds the picture. Notice Pythagorean values and assumptions there. Becoming embodied clouds the picture, so we forgot everything that we knew about the forms. So learning is remembering what we once knew before we were embodied. But you know, never mind all that. I mean, notice the emphasis there. You don't really need someone to come along and give you wisdom. You just need to find the wisdom that is already latent within you. That seems to be what he's getting at. So the average person doesn't lack knowledge, he has it already. Now, I don't know if this is true, but a number of times in Socrates, I have wondered whether he's not, without the categories, if he's not trying to just make a distinction between what a modern philosopher, Michael Polanyi, calls tacit knowledge versus articulate knowledge. And Polanyi was very helpful to me in a book called Personal Knowledge. That was a transformative book in my thinking, because he takes into account all the things we know that we don't know we know. And he gives the example, for example, of an 8-year-old boy riding the bicycle down the sidewalk. He knows how to ride the bicycle, but he couldn't come up to the blackboard and, you know, write out all the laws of angular momentum that keeps him upright on the bicycle as he goes down the hill. He couldn't articulate the knowledge that we know he has the knowledge because he ain't fallen over, right? So we know he has the knowledge, but it's at a level that he can't put into words or any language like the language of mathematics. He can't explain it to you. But it doesn't mean he doesn't know it. It just means he hasn't brought it to the level of articulation. There are a number of times in Socrates where what he's saying makes sense if you make that distinction, where he's acknowledging that something can be known tacitly without actually being articulated. So in a lot of those dialogues where he says, I guess we don't know what courage is, do we? I don't think he means that. I think what he means is, I guess we can't articulate it, can we? Does that mean we don't know it and that we don't understand it? Well, we've just been talking about it for a half an hour. We've given example after example of it. We can identify it when we see it. Isn't that knowing it? Don't we know it? But unlike the sophists, who presume to be able to put into words and sell it to you, unlike their pretense, we won't pretend. We won't pretend that we can articulate it. We will simply know it, I guess. So it seems to me that that's one of the themes of Socrates. Number six is to make clear that true virtue, true human excellence, is ultimately a gift from God. He ends the dialogue, the meno, with that the question is whether or not virtue can be taught. That's the discussion, the question being kicked around in the dialogue. Can virtue be taught? And virtue is not goodness. Virtue is human excellence. Can somebody teach you to be an excellent human being? And Socrates argues that that's one of those where I think, if I remember correctly, in that dialogue, he argues both sides of the thing. He convinces himself that it can be taught and then that it can't be taught. But the dialogue basically ends with, well, I guess it must be a gift from the gods. Now, that's after having, if not in that dialogue, in another dialogue, having said, well, it has to be taught because virtue, all virtue is rooted in understanding. In fact, in the dialogue that is on courage, what's really interesting is he boils courage down to understanding. Because a courageous man is not a rash man. You know, just being fearless does not make you courageous. A courageous man knows what to do as well as he's not only not afraid, but he also has the understanding to know how to use that, how to act in that fearlessness. But if he doesn't have understanding, he's just a fool. He's just a rash, reckless fool. Well, a rash, reckless fool is not courageous. He's a rash, reckless fool. So courage has to be subsumed by something like understanding. And I think what he's arguing there is all the virtues ultimately are rooted in understanding. Again, a doctrine that is very similar to the biblical worldview. In Jesus, we have all the treasures of wisdom and understanding, Paul says in Ephesians, Colossians. Look how often the apostles talk about, and in connection with Jesus, how we have knowledge, how we have understanding. That's not very popular in modern Christian culture. They accuse someone like me who emphasizes that of being a Gnostic. You know, I'm a Gnostic because I'm emphasizing knowledge. But I'm just reflecting what the apostles say. What we want to do is say, no, because it's this personal relationship with Jesus Christ, right? That's what our faith is all about. And our personal relationship with Jesus Christ is not about knowledge and understanding. It's about worship and love and service and this and that. But all that head stuff, that's a distraction. That's the enemy of true faith, of true worship, and all that kind of stuff. Well, tell that to the apostles. I mean, they take exactly the opposite perspective, that all of that begins, if it has any validity at all of that begins in the ground of knowledge and understanding. Well, that's a theme in Socrates, that it all ultimately at the foundation of all of the virtues, of anything that is virtuous, at its foundation is knowledge and understanding. And since it's knowledge and understanding, you ought to be able to teach it, right? I mean, isn't that what knowledge is? Is something that you can convey, you know, rationally and intellectually? So you ought to be able to teach it. And he makes that argument. And then he makes the argument, but look at all these knowledgeable and wise people that had really, really lousy sons. And all these lousy sons, I mean, surely they would have taught their sons if they could teach them. Surely they would have taught them the wisdom that they knew. So I guess it can't be taught, can it? So on the one hand, it ought to be able to be taught. On the other hand, you can't teach it. At least our experience says you can't teach it. So what's with that? And he ends by saying, I guess it must be a gift from the gods, which is exactly what we find in the biblical worldview. Yes, there is knowledge there to be conveyed and can be conveyed from one mind to the other. That's true, that it is there. But grasping it is another. Grasping it and embracing it with your very being is a whole nother issue. I mean, I can grasp it with my mind and I can feed it back to you. You know, you can take me to a catechism and I can learn my lines and I can feed them back to you and I can even understand what I'm saying. But that's not going to change my life. That's not going to make me a child of God. That's not going to make me a believer. What makes me a believer is if I own it and I embrace it and I actually define my existence by choosing to live my life in the light of that understanding. And no father can make his son do that. No teacher, no sophist can make his disciple do that. I guess the only one who can make somebody do that is the gods. It must be a gift from the gods. So very compatible with a biblical perspective. And then finally, and I've got to let you go, what his project was not, and I kind of already mentioned this last week, I think, but it's not to teach people the true picture of reality, a true picture of the cosmos and everything in it. Rather, it's to teach people what to love and what to pursue. That's certainly his predominant focus. And he basically is very agnostic and very humble when it comes to metaphysics. Don't know what's out there and don't know what's in the afterlife and stuff like that. But what I do know is you need to love truth, beauty, and goodness, and that's what you need to pursue, because then you're doing well by your soul. And that, if anything, that would be the bottom line of Socrates' teaching. Well, reminder, we don't meet next week. The day before Thanksgiving we won't meet, but we will come back one more week, the week after that, and then we'll be done through the holidays and done for the term. So we'll finish up the last little bit on Socrates and go on to introduce you to Plato 2 weeks from tonight.